Hello and welcome to Real Living. This is Lavinia Spirito with Mary Lou Nemecek, and we are going through a great article that somebody sent me off the LifeSite website, but it is an opinion piece that was written. I don't know if we have an author here.
I don't think we do.
We don't have an author, but anyway, it's credited to the LifeSite website, and it's LifeSiteNews.com/opinion/the 8 stages of the rise and fall of civilizations one, and each one of those words has a dash in between if you want to look it up on the internet. The reason I thought this article was fascinating because it talks about the stages and rise and falls of civilizations, which is something that we all know about. You know, I don't think you have to be a rocket scientist to know that many things repeat themselves through history, right?
That's the famous saying, history repeats itself.
Not in the sense, we should probably make a little distinction, and that is history repeats itself. But history is not a wheel, because that is the karmic perception of time. So that would be kind of a pantheistic, immanentistic way to perceive time, whereby we're just caught and trapped in the wheel of time, and none of us could ever get free, and what goes around comes around, and we can never progress linearly. That is, we can never improve our condition. We're just fatalistically accepting the next thing. That's not what we're talking about. Okay.
No, and that would disregard our free will, because we do have a free will to change things.
Exactly.
We're equipped to do that, and that's what's so heartening about having that and recognizing that we are not in the wheel, as you just described.
Nevertheless, human beings are what they are, and in the end, there's really only one great sin, and that is pride and autonomy, trying to detach ourselves from the plan of the Creator and from the will of God for our lives. And so because of these things, humans tend to repeat the same mistakes, not because we're caught in a karmic wheel, but because people tend to repeat the same mistakes. So the cycle that's being described here, it's based, I think he said, on the Scottish philosopher
Alexander Tyler.
Titler, actually. Titler. T-Y-T-L-E-R. Of the University of Edinburgh. He was 1747 through 1813. And his idea was that there's 8 stages. Now, last time we articulated that there was also Giambattista Vico, who was an Italian historian, who also sort of postulated theory of various stages of time. He called it the corsi ricorsi storici, the repeating events of history. And he used that, Giambattista Vico did, and Alexander Titler and all those guys, Titler, to illustrate the fact that human beings seem to always fall in the same mistakes. And so what do we mean by that? Well, you know, we talk about the ancient empires of the past. So we can even go back as far as the Sumerians and the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Persians. That chapter in Daniel, I forget which, I think it may be at the beginning of the book of Daniel, chapter 2, 3, 4, 5, somewhere in there, he speaks about the various empires that have occurred up to that point, and then he also prophesies going forward how these various empires will be conquered by the successor, and then the successor will be conquered by their successor, and so forth. And in Daniel's vision, he sees the Babylonian Empire, then he sees the Persians coming in, conquering them, and then he sees the Greeks, and then he sees the Romans, and then if far out into the distance, he sees the rock that will come and sort of destroy all the empires and establish a new everlasting kingdom. And that, of course, is the rock of the church and Jesus Christ himself, right? But I'm saying that to say that there's these idea that various empires, kingdoms, great world powers have a certain pattern as to how they happen to come to power, but then also how they happen to sort of go to hell in a handbasket, if we were to say in the vernacular, sort of to disintegrate, right?
Right.
So he's identified these stages from the very beginning. He presumes that a population or a civilization that it will emerge into greatness has first been in bondage. So that was the first the first stage was from bondage to spiritual growth. And he gives the example of the ancient Jews. Then he goes from spiritual growth to great courage. Well, something has to happen. We're in slavery. We're in bondage. We can't go on like this. Somebody's got to step up to the plate, right? And right. So through the crucible of suffering, of bondage, somebody steps forward. People who have little or nothing have nothing to lose, and they just step forward. So look what happened to the American Revolution. They were getting taxed out of their lives. They were getting an unbearable tax burden that did not correspond to the representation that they were that they had with their British overlords. And so finally, the balance tipped. And when they had nothing to lose, they kind of stepped forward, and you had that great courage. The third one, of course, is courage to liberty. The courage rallies everybody up, and you have the American Revolution, for instance. And then from at that point, after the American Revolution, you have liberty. And then from a liberty, of course, the first danger, abundance. And then, like, because, you know, most human beings are the same, from abundance, when you no longer have to worry about whether the Brits are going to come knock your door down and kill all your cattle and et cetera, you arrive to a stage in which you're fat and happy. And then from there, it's a very short step to complacency. So that's the step that we were had at the end of our show yet last time. To be complacent means to be self-satisfied and increasingly unaware of serious trends that undermine health and the ability to thrive. Everything looks fine. Now, you know, again, we bring this up because we think that there is a lot to be seen in here about the state of our own society.
That's right. And you know, when everything looks fine, you feel as though you don't need to do anything. It's not going to touch you. It's not going to affect you because you're fine. Whereas there's all these currents underneath that will affect you, as we're seeing in today's world.
That's right. And if you dare to point out that something is not right, you're a prude. Or you're a cool, you're judging, you're harsh, you're, you know, judgmental. But unfortunately, the next step that he outlines here, the author of this article, is from complacency to apathy, which is such a, just such a, I think, a risk for our culture today. The word apathy comes from the Greek and refers to a lack of interest in or passion for things that once animated and inspired. I mean, just look at the progression in the past 40, 50 years, even in the United States, where we've gone from an interest in literature and discussing books and discussing current events and becoming involved, in, you know, being involved in the at least having ideas about the political process and having a decent education, to basically the 24/7 news cycle and the 30-second soundbite attention span, where, you know, there's nothing that is going to grab our attention unless it entertains us. Due to the complacency of the previous stage, the growing lack of attention to the disturbing trends advances to outright dismissal. Oh, this actual revolution. No, it wasn't a revolution. That was just a development in a state of human morality. And now we're more enlightened. So now we can sleep with whoever we want. And sex is actually a sports event. You know, it's like it's a recreational event, and there are no we have to legislate sexual expression without any strings attached, without any consequences, because that is what we have become accustomed to.
Well, we shared ethics and morality in the same way. We all felt like we thought the same way, that we reacted the same way in the past. And as you're describing, all of that has changed. And there are no consequences, it seems, for whatever choices you make regarding marriage or family or anything else. It's all being redefined as we sit here today. It could change tomorrow.
Or even just crooked business practices or incorrect political expression or political philosophies that completely usurp religious expression. I mean, we have quite a few examples, unfortunately, to pick from. Civilization suffers a serious blow of being replaced by, and this is where we are now, one of the things we're in now, by personalization and privatization. Working and sacrificing for others doesn't matter anymore. Growing numbers become increasingly willing to live on the carcass of previous sacrifice. They park on someone else's dime, but not filling the parking meters themselves. Hard work and self-discipline continue to erode. The prime example of that, I think, is in Europe and in Japan, where people have stopped reproducing. They stop having children. And millions and millions of people are about getting ready to retire, and there's nobody after them to fund the retirement system, the pension systems, to look after them in their old age. I mean, there's a big bill that's coming due in the West, especially in Europe and in Japan, in the next 20, 30 years, where baby boomers retire and there is nothing there. There's no safety net. There's no people after them, or very few. So I'd say that's a pretty good example
of
someone else's dime.
And what better way to learn about sacrificing for others than having children?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that family commitment and mm-hmm. the ups and downs and the struggles involved in raising children, which at times seem so overwhelming. But really, there's so much more joy than anything in it, to see these young things grow up and hopefully become people of value who do share mm-hmm. Some form of virtue to go out and do something well and good for others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for themselves too. So
absolutely.
You know, what comes to mind is about the demographic suicide of, especially of Europe at this point, of Western Europe, is the fact that the leaders themselves are no longer equipped to understand the necessity to have children. Look at the creepy fact pointed out, I think, by George Weigel recently. Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, has no children. Emmanuel Macron, the new premier of France, is married to a lady who is lovely, but she's 64, so and has no children. The British prime minister is childless. The Italian prime minister is childless. The Spanish prime minister is childless. So on and so forth. And I think they are probably prime examples of their political class, where basically the emphasis has been on getting ahead and not having children. And I'm not saying that they can't understand the need to replace generations of people, but there is that, it's kind of a very disquieting example of where a European intelligentsia and the political machine has gone. You sacrifice everything for the career, you do not have children, and then who do you leave it to?
Nobody.
Right? So that is the sixth stage, from complacency to apathy, but it only gets worse. Mm-hmm. The seventh stage, from apathy to dependence. Increasing numbers of people lack the virtues and zeal necessary to work and to contribute. Does that sound familiar?
Oh, indeed it does.
The suffering and the sacrifices that built the culture are now a distant memory. As discipline and work increasingly seem too hard, dependence grows. The collective culture now tips in the direction of dependence, which is where we are now. Suffering of any sort seems intolerable. We will do anything as a culture to eliminate suffering from our lives, even if it's just a breakout on our faces, you know, or our gray roots are growing in, or we have to immediately cover it up or make it better, or we can't suffer pain. If we suffer too much pain, somebody's going to show up with a syringe and try to euthanize us because the quality of our lives is no longer worth living. So you have that idea that somehow we have to avoid suffering at all costs. The collective culture now tips in the direction of dependence. Suffering of any sort is avoided, but virtue is not the solution. Having lived on the sacrifices of others for years, the civilization now insists that other people must solve their woes.
That describes society today.
Isn't that what Thatcher used to say? The problem with socialism is that eventually you run out of other people's money.
Exactly.
That's exactly what we're talking about.
And that's what's happening. Yeah, it's all up to others to take care of us, and we don't have to do a thing.
And you have this hysterical insistence on how the government has to solve all our problems, how somehow, somewhere, somebody in some state house somewhere has to pass a law, quote unquote, to make things better or to stop groups from doing this and that and the other. This in turn deepens dependence as solutions move from personal virtue and local family-based sacrifices to centralized one. And we have that here. Somehow the federal government has to come in to the states and tell them how to regulate marriage, how to regulate births, how to regulate or even establish things like abortion. The federal government, now we're talking, of course, about the United States, but it's fairly clear also in Europe with the EEC regulations that come in a very draconian fashion from Brussels, telling people in Crete how big the tomatoes are that they can grow. You know, people in Brussels telling farmers in Germany, in the Schleswig-Holstein, how big their cows can be. And, you know, that kind of nitpicky sort of stuff, well, that's the centralized solution that is supposed to be so good for us. But in the end, it turns out to be nothing. It turns out to be the opposite, really. And then the final phase, which is the most chilling one, once you have passively reduced yourself to dependence, from there, it is a very short step to giving the reins over of your life to a centralized power. And once that happens, a centralized power is very susceptible to abuse. As dependence increases, so does centralized power. Dependent people tend to become increasingly dysfunctional and desperate. Hello, look at reality TV, right?
We're reaching that point right now.
Talk about dysfunction as entertainment. Seeking a savior, they look to strong central leadership. But centralized power corrupts and tends to usher in increasing intrusion by centralized power. Because, you know, I mean, we don't have to tell anybody over the age of 50 about the abuses of the totalitarian institutions in the 20th century.
Yes, but the young people these days look on that with favor. They think it's great, the state taking care of us. They just don't know what socialism really is.
Well, and they must not remember, or maybe they haven't studied or they haven't learned what happened under Stalin and what happened under Hitler and what happened under Pol Pot and what happened under Idi Amin Dada and whatever happened under Papa Doc Duvalier in Haiti, what happened under Mao Zedong in communist China. Those are all examples of totalitarian governments that take over not only the production and the economic and the political well-being of their citizens, but every single aspect. And the totalitarian government, a clear fruit of the totalitarian government is the imposition, for instance, in China up until a few years ago, of the one-child policy. Right. You don't get to have but one child. And if you have another child, you are forever penalized. Now, of course, they've apparently abridged that policy. So now you can have two children. But seriously, first of all, overpopulation has turned out to be more and more of a myth. You know, the fact that somehow by, you know, 2060, there's going to be 18 billion people and they'll be falling off the planet. In fact, right now, there is enough room for every human being on Earth to inhabit by him or herself 5 square miles. What they really mean when they talk about the myth of overpopulation is they mean that not everybody will be able to live in a city. That's what they mean. Not everybody will be able to be urban. People will have to remain in the farming areas, in the hinterlands, in the areas that it might be less desirable. But the fact that this myth of overpopulation, basically what they're saying is people won't be able to go to Mexico City and work anymore, or people won't, you know, there just won't be enough room in Tokyo for such. But there is plenty of room for people to thrive, depending on how they adapt their lifestyle, which they have done in the past. But now everybody has to be urban, and everybody has to have 3 phones, and everybody has to have 2 cars, and everybody has to have the vacation, and everybody has to have, you know, all the various perquisites of modern life, which I'm not saying that we shouldn't have them. But when you subordinate how many kids you're going to have because you want to go on vacation, or you want to have two or three cars instead of having to worry about children, there is, we submit anyway, something out of whack. And the author of this article, I think, agrees.
Well, he does agree. And not only that, everything is being measured by our you know, what we do in terms of climate control. I mean, human beings seem to be blamed for so many things now as we're the problem. You know, I think if you look at history, there have been many times when we've been good servants of what was given to us. And, you know, I think that there's just a lot of, again, misinformation out there about our footprint, about, you know, as you're saying, the lack of virtue. Mm-hmm. And because of that, what are the results? Everything that you've been talking about, limiting the family. And it's all a lie. It's just untrue.
Annihilating the family more is more like it, right?
Right. It's in today's world of this immediate information, the 24/7, you can pick up and read anything for or against anything we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And nobody's going to the sources. Nobody's going back in history, as this article is reminding us, to go back and look what's happened in these different civilizations. And where is this coming from? And how does it look like what we're doing today, which we're repeating all of these mistakes?
You know, C.S. Lewis in the 40s or 50s, I forgot, wrote many things. But he wrote what is now known as the Space Trilogy. And it starts with Out of the Hidden Planet, Out of the Silent Planet. It continues with Perelandra, and then it closes with That Hideous Strength, the last volume. And the last volume, he posits that somehow a shadowy bureaucracy takes over a small town, kind of as a dry run for taking over the country of Great Britain, for instance, mm-hmm. and submits every aspect of the life of the people who quote unquote work there to their control. And it turns out very quickly that even though they pretend that their control over these people is benign and that it's only work related, they are coming into their very souls and corrupting them. And I thought, in the name of bureaucratic efficiency, in the name of utilitarianism, in the name of consumerism, yeah, I would recommend you all go out and read that, because read the whole series, because he had such a knack for identifying trends in the modern world and where they were going to go and where they came from. And I think that this fits beautifully with these stages that we're talking about, because at the end of the road, you have a civilization that is in bondage. They're in bondage to the government. They're in bondage to public bureaucratic solutions, political solutions only, and family and personal virtue, which are essential ingredients for any civilization. Let's remember what we talked about when we talked about Christian leadership. The family, right, and the church are the primary institutions of humanity. And it is only when those two institutions are safeguarded that humanity will be able to flourish in the way that they're supposed to flourish, right? But instead now, they're being replaced by an increasingly dark and despotic, that means bossy, centralized control, hungry for more and more power. So it's not enough that we're being legislated out of existence, then there's a series of crippling administrative regulations that come in on top of the legislation. And then we have local ordinances that also ban us from having, nativity scenes in the public square, for instance, because God knows they are going to injure somebody, or posting the Ten Commandments, because that is a unwarranted and prohibited sign of religious expression, and God forbid we can't have that, right? Or if we do that, then we have to give the Satanists somewhere that
equal happens, time,
you know, equal time.
Yeah,
as if it were anyway. So there's a lot of confusion, right? So in this way, the civilization is gradually ended, because people in bondage no longer have the virtues necessary to fight. You know, we speak about virtues. It's funny because last night, you know, when you're like half asleep and you're in the middle of the night and like you're trying to pray for people. But then I kept thinking about the seven cardinal virtues, you know, obviously the theological virtues, faith, hope, and love. But all through the night, I kept saying prudence, courage, justice, and temperance. Prudence, courage, justice, and temperance. Those, brothers and sisters, are what we need. Prudence, temperance, or self-control, courage, or fortitude, and justice. All those things kept in balance under the platform of faith, hope, and love.
Love.
That's the answer. That's why we need the virtues, because only when society is virtuous will be able to sustain the effort to come back to a just society, to come back to a civilization that supports life instead of banning life, that supports people instead of only valuing them for their contribution, which is, of course, another word for utilitarianism or for consumerism. So either we're setting ourselves up for continued bondage so that a strong man will come in at a certain point, or a political philosophy of totalitarianism will come in again, such as what happened in Europe, for instance, in the middle of the 20th century, and we will be ripe, like little pears falling off a tree, into the thresher of a totalitarian government, which will tell us how to think, how to speak.
They're already controlling
all our thoughts.
What we do.
Right? Yeah,
yes.
All our expression is somehow subjected to some form of censorship. And it's not the kind of censorship that you would think. It's a censorship of political correctness, right? So either that happens, or a more powerful nation or group is able to enter by invasion or replacement and destroy the final vestiges of a decadent civilization and replace it with their own culture. Now, you don't think that's possible? That's possible. Because just like the Roman Empire was replaced by the various barbarian invasions, and then the synthesis of the Roman Empire and the barbarian invasions became the Holy Roman Empire under Charlemagne, and it lasted for several centuries, but then it decayed, and then was picked back up, of course, under Charles V and the whole European Renaissance. But even that, the Industrial Revolution, the cycles, how about the great empire of the Habsburgs? You know, that the sun does not set on that empire. How about the British Empire? How about the great colonial powers that seem to think that nothing was ever going to happen to them? Well, they've gone by the boards. And just like from the beginning in the Roman Empire and the Babylonian Empire, the indicators of decay, of moral decay, are the signposts that things are about to get ugly and that the civilization itself will disintegrate. So, I mean, it's sobering thought, but I thought this article was so well put that we should propose it for you all to kind of see if you recognize anything. It's back, because then after you tip back into bondage, then you go back all over again, right? And you become basically another version of the Israelites in the book of Judges, being persecuted by the Amalekites and the Jebusites and the Hivites and the Perizzites and all the various ites who would come in and enslave them when they had gotten fat and happy and complacent and apathetic. And then they would cry out for delivery, for deliverance, and then God would raise up a judge and he would free them, and then they would have a period of flourishing, and then they would fall right back into apathy, and then they would get run over again. And so that's kind of like a cycle that we see. Suffering and conflict bring about enough wisdom, virtue, and courage necessary to begin a new civilization. So, you know, maybe that's the way that things happen. Remember, few nations have lasted longer than 200 years, and us living in the West at the beginning of the third millennium would do well to take that to heart.
Well, that's why it's so important for you and I and everybody, each of us individually, to work to go back to a virtuous foundation, to go back to or to share the church's teachings, because the church was the one that during its time, you know, set up the hospitals, the schools, the governments, and so forth, that did not control the people, that provided the necessary foundations for people to thrive, knowing that government was secondary to the eternal, to God, that The government wasn't the end of it all. It wasn't the total control. It was subject to God.
That's the conclusion of this article. The only true ark of safety is the church, who received her promise of invincibility and of indefectibility from the Lord. Matthew 16:18, behold, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of the netherworld will not prevail against it. Any netherworld. But the church is always in need of reform and will have to suffer. And yet she alone can survive in this changing world because she is the bride of Christ and also his body. So the sentence that has been going through my mind, and I know I've shared with you before, is put not your trust in princes. All throughout the election last year and even before, Psalm 136, verse 3, put not your trust in princes. Put your trust in the Lord, because the Lord will preserve his people as he did in the old covenant. He will preserve those of us who are now joined to him in the new covenant. Find your place in the ark of the church and strive to live a life of virtue in faith, hope, and love. Thank you for joining us.